My name is Patricia Baird, and this is the last evening I'll be welcoming you as president of the Vancouver Institute, because Dr. Cheryl Grace takes over in January. So it's a good time for me to note the tremendous contribution that Dr. Peter Nemetz continues to make to the thriving of the Institute. Without the enormous personal commitment and the generous allocation of his time and his work, we simply would be unable to have the stellar lineup of speakers that we do. And I think we're all in his debt, and as he carries on the Nemetz family tradition behind the scenes. However, I would like him to step out from behind the scenes. And Peter, would you stand up so we can... Now, if you aren't a member of the Institute, I'd like to encourage you very much to join. We still have 10 outstanding speakers to come before we recess next spring, and I've just got the program for the spring, and it ranges from topics such as will theater survive, to remote sensing, to Alzheimer's disease. So I think it's going to be a very interesting miscellany of topics in the spring. This year, as well, we're trying to encourage people who feel like giving us a donation because we're giving a free book which has texts of lectures from the last 3 years to anyone who donates over $75. So that's the commercial's over for the evening. And I'm going to tell you now about our speaker tonight, Dr. Gail Anderson. Dr. Anderson received a first-class honors degree in zoology from Manchester University. She came to Canada and earned a master's degree and then a PhD degree in medical and veterinary entomology from Simon Fraser University. She's got wide interests in the field of insect and other arthropod-borne diseases, both in humans and in animals. And she's had several active research projects in areas that are related to those interests. But I think it's her groundbreaking work in forensic entomology, in particular, that's captured the public's imagination and for which she has received a great deal of attention. And this part of her research is aimed at advancing knowledge of the insects that are associated with dead bodies so that that knowledge can be applied in police and other investigations. And her work has been featured in several television programs on Discovery Channel and on The Nature of Things, for example. And another interesting thing she's doing is currently spearheading the development of a Canada-wide database of insects relevant to forensic medicine. I think when that resource is finally up and running, and maybe she'll say something about it tonight, it's going to be quite invaluable. I think recognition of the practical as well as the scholarly value of her work is shown by the fact that her academic position is funded jointly by the university, the BC Coroner's Service, and the RCMP. Professor Anderson has acted as a consultant to investigations across the country, as well as testifying as an expert witness in many court cases. So I'm very pleased indeed to welcome here tonight Dr. Gail Anderson, who's going to talk to us on the intriguing topic, Murder and Maggots, the Use of Insects in Criminal Investigation. Dr. Anderson.
Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming out tonight on such an unpleasant evening. The forensic investigation of a crime involves a very large team. It involves a diverse group of people with a diverse knowledge and technology of various aspects of science. So all the aspects of a criminal investigation involve a lot of people. Some of the people I know are here tonight. And it isn't the forensic science that solves a crime. It's good investigators that solve a crime using forensic science. Tonight I want to show you a little bit of my forensic science, and that is forensic entomology. Entomology, as I'm sure you're aware, is the study of insects. Forensic entomology is the study of those insects that are associated with a dead body, with a view primarily to determining when somebody died. Now, we can use insects to determine many other things at a death investigation, such as determining whether or not the body has been moved from one place to another after death by the killer, or whether or not the body has been disturbed after death, again, by the killer returning to the scene of the crime. We can use insects to determine whether or not the victim used drugs. We can use it to determine the position and the presence of wound sites. We can use it in child and senior abuse cases, and we can use it in poaching cases as well. But primarily, an entomologist is called into a crime scene to determine when somebody died. Why do we need to know when? Well, in any kind of a death investigation, whether it's a suicide or an accident or a perfectly natural death, it's very important for us as human beings to know when somebody died. It's part of our grieving process if it's your loved one. You know how people always say, well, it's been almost 3 weeks. It's been a year. Do you know it's been almost 3 years? It's the way we think, it's the way we relate to it. It's very important to us to be able to pigeonhole that and know when death occurred. But when it becomes a homicide, it becomes vital to know when somebody died. Knowing when can make or break an alibi. It can quickly exonerate an innocent person. It also aids in the identification of an unknown victim. When you have a completely unknown victim, perhaps skeletonized, it's very difficult to work out who that person is. If you cannot identify the victim, you have almost no chance of catching the killer. We hopefully will have teeth that we can identify the victim by. But of course, not everybody has teeth. Or the victim might have lovely teeth, but the dental work may not come from this country, so we can't trace it back. Or of course, the victim might not have a head. It happens. So by pointing the investigation into the correct time frame, showing the police the window of time in which death has taken place, it gives them a starting point. It gives them a place to start looking to try to work out through the missing person's records, perhaps, who that person is. So it points the investigation into the correct time frame, speeding up the investigation, saving a lot of money, of course, and hopefully helping to solve the crime. Now, a forensic entomologist is usually involved in a case when the victim has been dead for at least 72 hours. That's because up until this time, there are other experts, primarily the pathologist, who can be as accurate or more accurate than I can be. But after 72 hours, insect evidence is the most accurate and frequently the only way of determining when somebody died. Aside, of course, from a confession, and in one notable case, I was actually more accurate than the killer. I could tell him when he committed the crime, but he was a little vague on the idea exactly. Now, I do get called in sometimes in cases where somebody has been dead for less than 72 hours, a matter of hours after death sometimes, and that's usually up to the pathologist. It's the pathologist's prerogative at that point to call me. Now, forensic entomology is not a new subject. People are inclined to think it is because they're just beginning to hear about it, but it actually dates back to 13th century China. Back then, a man killed another man with a sickle. Having committed the crime, he cleaned off the knife blade, so he wasn't seen wandering through town with a bloody knife in his hand. But he cleaned it off as far as the human eye was concerned. He didn't clean it from the point of view of the insects. When the head man of the village discovered what had happened, he asked every man in the village that owned such a knife to come forward, line up against the wall, and lay the knife on the ground in front of him so that he could examine it and see if there were any clues there or something. Well, you picture the scene. There's maybe 50 guys standing there, each with a nice shiny knife blade on the ground in front of them. And all of a sudden, thousands of flies land on just one knife. Now, we know why that happened, of course. Obviously, there was enough blood and stuff left on the knife to be attractive to the insects. Of course, the killer didn't understand this. He took this to be a message from God, dropped to his knees and confessed. It's not quite the same way as we use the insects today, but it was a beginning. Using insects very much as we use them today began in Europe in the 1850s. And made it to Britain in about the 1930s. It didn't make it across to North America, though, until about the 1970s. And I don't know why it took so long to come to North America. I suspect what happens was there was a conference in Europe, and a lot of North Americans went and thought, hello, we can do that. And it began in about three areas in North America in the 70s. One of those areas was in British Columbia, and that was Simon Fraser University. Now, forensic entomologists are fairly few and far between. There's not too many of us out there. There's about 10 in the US who are very actively involved in the science, probably another 10 who dabble. And there's only one full-time forensic entomologist in Canada right now, and that's me. Hopefully this will change. I hope that eventually we will see at least one person like myself per province, maybe more. And in other parts of the world, it is quite different. This summer, a colleague of mine, Inspector Jean-Marc Vien from the French police, came and visited me. I wasn't quite sure what to do with a visiting forensic scientist, so when in doubt, take him to an autopsy. So luckily, we had an autopsy to take him to. He wanted this photograph taken so he could prove to his wife he was working when he was in Vancouver. Jean-Marc is the head of the French Forensic Entomology Department. It is a department of 9 full-time forensic entomologists. And when we met, he said, so, how many of you are there in Vancouver? I said, well, there's me. And he said, and for British Columbia? I said, well, there's me. He said, for all of Canada? I said, well, there's still me. So we sincerely hope that we will take the lead of other countries and start having a lot more forensic entomologists across the country and involved in this field. But one of the big advances we have made in North America is the establishment of a board certification. We established this in 1996, the American Board of Forensic Entomology. This is a board certification similar to that the pathologists belong to, that forensic odontologists and forensic anthropologists belong to. And so far, there are 8 board-certified forensic entomologists in North America, of which I am the only Canadian. Now, I am quite serious here. In a talk naturally of this type, some of my slides can be considered a little bit distasteful. This isn't one of them. The basic premise of forensic entomology is that insects are commonly the first witnesses to the crime. They arrive immediately after death, usually within minutes. You know how long it takes a fly to land on a steak if you leave it out on a summer's day. So assuming the season is appropriate, that is, it's not January in northern Manitoba, insects will arrive on the body very, very quickly. They'll certainly arrive within 24 hours, but usually within minutes. They're attracted primarily to a wound site, if there is a wound site. And of course, in a homicide victim, there usually is. Not always, but usually. And so here you can see this grazed area underneath the horse's eye. And these black dots here, these are all flies attracted to the wound site. They're not interested in up here or down here. They're interested in that wound site. So they'll go to the wound site first if there is one. If there's no wound, no problem. They just go for the natural orifices. Now, this gentleman is dead, but very recently dead. There's no outward signs of putrefaction. And you can see there's already 2 flies have shown an interest in his nostrils, and 1 fly has actually already laid an egg in his nostril here. This is why you don't go to sleep on the beach with your mouth open. There are 2 ways of using insects to determine time of death. The first is looking at successional waves of insects. And this is used when somebody's been dead for about a month, up to a year, and in some cases longer than a year. And the second method is looking at larval development. And this is used in the first few hours, weeks, or months after death. And I'm going to show you the science behind each of those techniques and show you some case examples so that you can see how they work in real life. The first method, succession ecology, is just basic high school ecology. The dead body, be it a dead human being or a dead animal for that matter, is a food resource. It's a bag of nutrients. And as it decomposes, it goes from fresh to skeletonized in a relatively rapid period of time. And as it goes through that decomposition, it goes through rapid physical, biological, and chemical changes. And this body, this nutrient source, supports a rapidly changing ecosystem. So different insects are attracted to different stages of that decomposition. Some insects are attracted to the body when it's fresh. These are the kind of insects we try to keep away from our food because we like our food fresh too. Other insects like the body when it's been dead 2 or 3 days. Some when it's been dead a week. Some when it's been dead a month. Some when it's been dead several months, etc. And this is a predictable sequence of insect colonization. Now, it's different if the body is in sun or shade. It's different if the body is buried or above ground. It's different here than it will be in northern BC or in Tennessee are in France. But it is predictable within these sort of parameters. So if you know the sequence of insects that you expect to have colonizing in this particular circumstance, you can predict how long the body has been dead. So you'll look at the insects and say, well, these insects were here. They're not here anymore, but they've left evidence of themselves behind. These insects are here now because we can see them. And the next group of insects are not yet here. So this is our window of time in which death must have taken place. This is a case from northern BC. In this case, a young girl went missing, a young girl about 14 years old. She was last seen in the presence of her boyfriend, who was about 15 or 16 years old. She went missing in March, and this is way up north in Canada. The young boy was the obvious suspect. He'd been last seen alone with her. The police questioned him closely, but could get nowhere with him. Eventually, they stopped questioning him. A year and a half later, the following June, the father of the boyfriend decided they were going to move house and informed the young boy that they were going to move house. This is the basement of the house in which the young boy lived, the boyfriend. This is the boy's room. It was his room. Nobody else had access to it. It was locked. It was his. And nobody had access to it for some time. Well, when the father informed the boy he was going to be moving house and they were going to have to move and clear up his bedroom, there was a lot of banging and knocking in this room. And then the boy disappeared. He went AWOL. The father was concerned and broke down the door. Inside, we see a homemade waterbed, the waterbed of the bladder itself removed. And the father saw, you can't quite see on the slide, just underneath where the boy was trying to break the bed apart, he saw a shoe with a human foot attached. He called the police. Here you can see the plastic removed from the waterbed, and you can see a rather ominous stain. And as we peel it back, the young girl is revealed in between the slats of the waterbed. I should point out that during this time frame, the boy was known to be using this bedroom and was bringing other girls back there. This is her state of her body at autopsy. Now, she's completely mummified, so you can see there's a lot of tissue still left. There was a lot of insect activity on her. Now, she was found in June in northern Canada. In June in northern Canada, it is still freezing at night. So the insect season has not yet begun. The fact there were an awful lot of insects on that body when we found her indicates her body must have been present, hanging around, during a summer season to have attracted those insects. She clearly didn't die in this winter. She must have been present as a dead body during the previous summer. However, the insects on the body were all the late stage insects, the insects that like a body when it's been dead for weeks or months or even years. There were no signs of any of the early stage insects, the maggots, the blowflies. Now, certainly we wouldn't have blowflies left anymore, but we would expect to see evidence of themselves left behind, and there was nothing. So obviously, she must have died before the insect season. She must have died considerably before the summer season up there and had a chance to mummify and become no longer attractive to any of the blowfly kind of insects by the time the insect season rolled around. Now, she went missing in March. She was found a year later in the following June. So this indicates that her death must have occurred considerably before the previous June and is quite consistent with her dying in the previous March. The young boy later did come forward and confess that he did, in fact, strangle her that night. Now, the second method is looking at larval development. And here we're looking at the immature stages, or the maggots, of blowflies. And these are the common blue or green, black, metallic, buzzy flies you see buzzing around in summer. Now, these are nature's little garbage recyclers. This can look fairly unpleasant, but it really is a very, very important part of nature. If it wasn't for these kind of insects recycling the nutrients from the body back to the earth, then we would be neck deep in dead things, literally. We desperately need these animals to keep recycling the body, and they do a very efficient job of it. This person has been dead about 3 days. Notice how the maggots are colonizing the natural orifices, the mouth, the nose, the eyes. 1 day later, they've taken off a lot of the flesh. And in one more day, the face is pretty much skeletonized. They're still there, they're just moving on down the body, taking out the rest of them. Now, these insects have a very predictable life cycle. The adult blowfly is attracted to the body to lay her eggs. And she lays the eggs close to a natural orifice or a wound. These eggs will hatch out after a set predictable period of time. And that period of time is dependent on temperature and on species. And on average is about 24 hours, give or take about 6 hours. So in 24 hours, you will have maggots on the body. Now these maggots will hatch into little first instar, first stage maggots. And these will feed, but they can only feed on body fluids like blood or on the mucosal layer, which is why the mother lays them close to a wound site. That's why she's so good at finding a wound site. She needs to. They feed for a little while, then molt to second instar. Feed for a little while, molt to third instar. They feed for a little while longer. And then they stop feeding and they change their behavior entirely. They start wandering away from the body, looking for a nice, safe, dry place to pupate. Now that's all very interesting from a biological standpoint, but it's vitally important from a forensic standpoint, because it means that my evidence just get up and walked away. Nobody else's evidence does this. You know, the bullets stay put, the gun stays put, but my evidence is alive and it gets up and walks. So it's really important for anybody who's actually doing the collection at the crime scene, if it's not myself, for whoever's doing it to realize that the insect evidence may often be around the body, not just on the body. And it's that evidence that might be the most important because it's the oldest evidence. It's the furthest along in the sequence. After a little while, it forms an outer pupil case in which it metamorphoses or changes through to the adult fly, leaving behind the empty pupil case as evidence that the cycle has gone through. Now, the time it takes to get through this cycle or to any stage in it depends primarily on temperature and species. Insect development is temperature dependent. As temperature increases, they develop more rapidly, so they go through that cycle quickly. When temperature decreases, they go through the cycle more slowly. And that is a relatively linear relationship. In other words, it's predictable. So when we look at insects on the body and we look at maggots, we look at the oldest insect stage because we want to know how far they've gone through their cycle. We look at the oldest insect stage. We determine what their species is in the lab. We get the weather records from the nearest Environment Canada weather station. And from that, we can work out how old the oldest insects are. So for instance, I might say, well, the oldest insects are 7 days old, meaning that the insects have been on the body for 7 days, so he's been dead for at least 7 days. Doesn't mean he died 7 days ago. It means he died at least 7 days ago. We always deal with minimums. This is a case of mine from quite some time ago. This is a very typical British Columbia type homicide scene, a logging road. Do not go hiking up logging roads. This is where we always find them. You can see the police markers here marking where other evidence has been seized. And you can see the start of the yellow line going off into the crime scene. The victims were two young women. They had been shot in the head with a single gunshot from a .22. They were found on May the 17th by two innocent hikers walking through the bush. Now you can see the maggots along here. You can see the white. These are maggots all through this area. Now the police did the collection at the crime scene. This was quite early on when I was just beginning, back around 1988. Now the police are much more used to calling me to crime scenes. I am always willing to go to a crime scene. I would always want to go to a crime scene. It's my neck on the line when I go into court, so I want to be there doing the collection myself. But this is in the early days, so the police did the collection for me. And you can see the officer doing the collection here. And they did a wonderful job of the collection. There's two things I would have liked them to do that they didn't do. One is that they only collected from the lady in blue. They didn't collect from the lady in black on the assumption that they died at the same time. Well, actually they had, we found that out later. But it would have been very embarrassing if this had been a serial killer dump site and they'd been killed 2 weeks apart, because we wouldn't have been able to tell. Also, it meant that I could only testify to the lady in blue. I could not testify to the lady in black. And I guarantee when they took the bullets out of the bodies, they didn't just take one out and say, well, this'll probably do. I guarantee if it was now we did DNA, they wouldn't have taken DNA from just one of them and said, well, that'll do for both of them. If we've got two bodies, we need two samples. As well, they collected from the bodies, but they did not collect insects from the surrounding region. Now, the oldest insects on the body were in the third instar, just ready to enter that prepupal stage. So it's quite possible that some of them had already done that. But I don't have that evidence, so I can't testify to it. So based on what I had, I estimated death had occurred on or before May the 6th. They were found on the 17th, remember. On or before May the 6th, and could have died several days before that, but could not have died after it. Well, I submitted this report, and later the police brought forward two eyewitnesses that swore they had seen the killings take place on May the 3rd. Well, that was fine. That fits with what I say. I say death has occurred on or before May the 6th and probably a couple of days before that. But just step back and think about that for a sec. We've got two eyewitnesses. The police brought them forward in a complex undercover operation. They did not come forward willingly. They say they saw these two women killed on May the 3rd. And they didn't mention it to anybody? Not even a little anonymous phone call? Granted, the police are not these people's favorite people, but still, this is not the kind of thing that is going to inspire the jury with the moral integrity of these two witnesses. But still, it's all we've got, and these are the two witnesses that can say he did it. So this is the main prosecution witnesses. All of a sudden, then, defense brings forward what was known in prosecution circles as the Elvis witnesses. You know, people that are always claiming they see Elvis all the time? Well, these two nice middle-aged ladies swore they had seen the upper victim. Luckily, it was the upper victim, the one I can talk to. The upper victim alive and well and shopping at the mall on May the 9th. Completely eliminates the testimony of the two young guys. Now, who are you going to believe? These two young guys who say they saw a killing but didn't bother to tell anybody? Well, these two nice middle-aged ladies, everybody's mother. It's going to be a battle of the witnesses, and this happens a lot. So all of a sudden, my testimony became vital. And I testified that death had occurred on or before May the 6th. It could quite easily have occurred on May the 3rd, when the two young guys said it did. But there was no way they could be alive and well and shopping at the mall on May the 9th. My testimony was believed by the jury. It supported that of the two young guys. It eliminated that of the two middle-aged ladies. And so when the two young guys got up on the stand and said, he did it, they were believed, and he was convicted of two counts of first-degree murder. I find my evidence does this a lot. It separates between two sets of witnesses. It's very difficult for a jury to work out who's telling the truth, who's the most believable person. Well, when you can put hard science down between them and show them who could or who could not be telling the truth, that can be very important to a trial. I just very briefly want to show you a decomposition sequence, because most people aren't aware of how very quickly decomposition takes place. This is an exercise I do in Ottawa every year as a training program for senior police officers at the Canadian Police College. Here's your typical crime scene again, your basic logging road. Here we have our victim, a sadly deceased pig from the local slaughter yard. Now the pig has been killed and was on his way to make pork chops when he was seized by the police. And so he has been killed in the natural manner of pork chops, and then the throat has been slit to bleed the animal out as it would be for human meat consumption, which is a reasonable simile of a human homicide, of course. But watch that wound. There's a wound right here in the neck. Next day. This is really high tech. Now look at that wound. Those are maggots. Tiny little maggots. Close up, you see that's all tiny little maggots in there. And in the mouth also. Close up at the mouth. Next day. Now look at that wound. See the maggots there, but also see this brown line here? That's maggots under the skin. So the actual maggot mass is this size. Back here, you can see it coming back towards the ear. See the extent of that. Now, the temperature inside that mass of maggots is very high. The ambient temperature here today, at this day, was about 28 degrees. So the internal temperature of that maggot mass is 40 degrees. And that's just the temperature of friction, you know, if you rub your hands together. It's the motion of the maggots rubbing up against each other. But of course, that is changing our microclimate drastically. So it's drastically changing the way we're going to have to analyze this kind of evidence. Notice most of the top end is gone. Temperature's still up there. Now the weekend has gone by. It's Monday morning. That's all that's left of our pig. Notice how it's collapsed over the spine, so all this tissue in here is gone also. Now we start to see some of the scavengers and predators come in. These are also part of the life cycle here. These animals are coming in not to feed on the body. They're coming on to feed on the insects that are feeding on the body. So you've got an entire little ecosystem happening here. It's kind of like pickpockets going to the P&E. The pickpocket didn't go to see the P&E. They came to pick the pockets of all the suckers who went to see the P&E. So that's why the scavengers are here. They're here because they know with the body there's going to be maggots. They're stealing maggots. And here you can see another one in here. You can't see the beetle very well, but you can see a big fat maggot in his face here. And now it's been a week. And that's all that's left of our pig. Now, there's a lot of insect activity still there. It doesn't look like it. A lot of the flesh is gone, of course. But the maggots will have all migrated into the dirt here. Fairly shortly, they'll pupate, and in a few more days, they'll emerge as adult flies, leaving that empty pupal case behind. But there's tons of food resources there for all sorts of other insects. The later successional insects are now going to start coming in. Lots of skin, lots of attraction for other insects. No interest for the maggots or the blowflies now there. Okay, another thing we can do with insects, as well as determine time of death. 99% of the time, we're determining time of death. But other things we can do involve determining things like the position and the presence of wounds. Insects, as I've said, colonize at a wound site first, if there is one, and if not, at the natural orifices. Now, when a body is highly decomposed, it's often difficult to see where the wound might be. You can't tell anymore, especially if that wound didn't impact the hard tissue, the skeleton. But if you look at the insect colonization patterns, and it doesn't quite fit, it's not quite what you would expect, it might indicate there is a wound here. Now, this is not something I would say. I would say there might be a wound here. It would be up to the pathologist always to determine whether or not there is or is not a wound. But the fact that the insects are colonizing in a strange way would give us the hint that there might be a wound pattern there. I always think this is a very sad case. It comes from the US. I've been involved in forensic entomology for over 10 years now. And I have been to innumerable autopsies and crime scenes, and I know how carefully these things are processed. I know how carefully we do these. Even when we think it's a natural death, they are still treated with the utmost care. So I don't believe we could have made this mistake in Canada. But having said that, I wouldn't have believed we'd have made it in Washington, D.C. either, and that's where this case comes from. So I guess the lesson is that this mistake can be made anywhere. If you haven't figured out what you're looking at yet, it's because of the appalling quality of these slides. These are the official police photographs. Gives you an idea of the quality of the investigation. She's a young girl, 14 years old, teenage girl, waistband, zipper of her jeans, legs. This is a maggot mass in her chest region, heads up here, arms flung this way. She went for a walk after dinner one day, and she didn't come home, and 9 days later she was found looking like this. Well, she was kind of smelly and a little disgusting and kind of covered in maggots, and they had a quick look and they said, oh, ick. Took her off to the morgue, had another quick look and said, well, she's a teenage girl and teenage girls are always committing suicide, so she's probably a suicide. So they buried her. That was it. That was the full extent of the autopsy. No internal autopsy was performed. Well, of course, the family were hysterical. They said under no circumstances was their daughter a suicide. But of course, the family always says that, so they were ignored. One of the police officers wasn't happy, though. And quite some time later, he showed the slides I'm showing you now to a colleague of mine, Dr. Bill Rodriguez, a forensic anthropologist in the U.S. with the U.S. U.S. Army Medical Examiner's Office. And Bill has a little knowledge of insects as well as anthropology, and he couldn't answer the anthropology question because of the appalling quality of the slides, but as the officer was leaving the room, he said, so do you have a suspect for this one yet? And the officer said, a suspect? She's a suicide. He said, oh, no way. It's not possible she's a suicide. For start, he said, look at the maggot mass in the chest region. But he said, much more importantly, look at the palms of her hands. I'm going to show you somebody else's hands first. This is a suicide. The gentleman shot himself in the head, and his chest is almost completely skeletonized. He was one of my early cases. He has been dead 9 days as well, exactly the same as our young girl. Notice the hand. This chest is skeletonized with maggots, but the hand is in excellent condition. Hands don't really decompose. There's not much to it. They just kind of dry up, and they certainly aren't a target of insect colonization. Why would be? There's nothing to be attractive here. So these hands preserve very, very well. In fact, we can still get fingerprints from people who've been dead for weeks, months. In fact, that's how we identified him. What happens is the skin comes off in sort of a glove, and then we collect that glove, and then the lowest ranking police officer in the room gets to put that glove on his fingers and then fingerprint it like it's his own fingers. It really pays to get promoted very quickly in the police, as far as I can work out. No, it's true. Fingerprints stick around. There was a case in Australia where a young guy was murdered and he was chopped into little pieces and thrown into the ocean. And one piece, the hand and a bit of the wrist, got eaten by a small shark. Shortly afterwards, the little shark got eaten by a bigger shark. Great. But then the big shark got caught in a trawler's net from a fishing vessel, alive. And they said, hey, interesting shark. Interesting species. Don't think the aquarium has one of these. So they donated the shark to the local aquarium. Local aquarium was suitably pleased with their new live shark, and they put it in a big demonstration tank right at the front. And they invited all the mummies and daddies and little kiddies to come out and see the cool new shark, advertised all across the city. And all, of course, the mummies and daddies and little kiddies came out to see the cool new shark. Meanwhile, the shark wasn't feeling very well, feeling a wee bit sick. Swam up and down the tank, feeling a wee bit nauseous for about 3 weeks. And then right in front of all the mummies and daddies and little kiddies, it vomited up one human hand. It was then fished out, taken down to the police station where it was fingerprinted. The fingerprints were still intact. The victim was identified, and when they could identify the victim, they were then able to work out who the most likely killers were. So hands and fingers stick around. This is a sequence from the Tennessee Body Farm, a sequence of a week's decomposition of a hand. This is a fresh hand. 1 day later, 2 days, beginning to look like he's been in the hot tub a wee bit too long. But notice the integrity of the skin is not broken at all. Now we see the skin beginning to slough, and you see what I mean by the glove coming off here. But notice underneath, the integrity of the skin is not broken. There's still fingerprint characteristics here. There's still ridged skin. So we can still get fingerprints on that too. The flesh is not broken. We're not into muscle tissue here. Now you can see teeny little maggots. Imagine what his face looks like about now. So this is not an area of activity for the insects. Not very attractive. Here's the glove we want. Little insects, but still the integrity of the flesh not broken. Now at a week, we're just beginning to see some breakage in the flesh. But this is typical. Hands are not particularly attractive to insects. Back to our young girl. Chest region is skeletonized. The face is not in bad condition. It's not great, I grant you, but it's not in bad condition. But look at the palm of the hand. It's a bad photograph, but that is a maggot mass. There's only one reason there would be a maggot mass in the palm of the hand, and that is most likely a defense wound. Dr. Rodriguez said, I believe that this young girl was attacked by somebody with a sharp instrument, most likely a knife, and she did what we would all do in such a circumstance. She grabbed the knife with her hand. She pushed the knife away to try to protect herself, and in so doing was very badly slashed. She was then stabbed in the chest. Based on this evidence, Dr. Rodriguez and the police officer worked hard to get the case reopened. Eventually they did, and she was exhumed. She was buried, remember, thank goodness, not cremated. She was buried, she was exhumed, and they did a second autopsy. And they did a slightly more careful autopsy this time, just on the off chance that maybe they missed something the first time. When they did the second autopsy, they found over 22 stab wounds in the chest region, all of which were missed at the first autopsy. She was slashed so deeply in the palms of the hand that in one case her thumb was almost completely severed, missed at the first autopsy. Her case is now reopened as a homicide, but the chance of catching a killer now is pretty slim. Had they used an entomologist right at the beginning, this case would never have been written off as a suicide. Another thing that we're doing with insects, most recently, is looking at poaching. Poaching is a very major crime in Canada, in the whole world. But Canada is the last country in the world, and I include America in this. Canada is the only country in the world that still has an elegant sufficiency of bears. And we will not have them for much longer if we keep losing them at the rate we're losing them. We're losing them for a lot of reasons, but one of the big ones is poaching. They're being poached for a variety of reasons. They're poached as trophies. They're poached for their parts, for their teeth and their claws. But they're poached primarily for their bear paws and, of course, for their gallbladders, which have an extremely high value in certain traditional medicines. So forensic entomology can be used in a poaching case just as easily as it can in a human homicide case. This case comes from a few years ago now. 5 black bears were killed outside of a garbage dump. They were all found just around the perimeter of this garbage dump. They had all been shot, disemboweled, their gallbladders removed. So they were all killed for profit. Cubs, of course, were left orphaned. And people got very concerned about this. And we're very concerned about these little cubs starving to death, etc. And the day that this newspaper reached the public was the same day that those 2 cubs were found shot, disemboweled, and their minute little gallbladders removed. The gallbladder is an animal this size. It's absolutely zero commercial value. So the guys didn't know what they were doing. They just thought it was a gallbladder. Now, an RCMP officer was called to the scene because gunshots were heard. And this is very important because the wildlife officers were not aware of forensic entomology. But the police officer was because he'd done many homicide cases with me before. I testified for him. He was aware of what this evidence could do. So the bears were found at 1600 hours on the 14th of July. The RCMP officer was called and collected evidence for me. The evidence were just eggs. The bears were very fresh. So he collected eggs for me, and he preserved half of them for me in alcohol, kept half alive. And he watched them, and at 2100 hours that night, they were still eggs. By the following morning, they had hatched. Now, had I actually had these insects in my hand, particularly had it been a homicide, but had I actually had them, I would have checked them through the night, because now my range of time of egg laying is quite wide. So we had three species of insects laid, and my range, as I say, is wide. They were laid sometime between midnight and 9 o'clock in the morning of discovery. But eggs are not laid at night. Blowflies don't buzz around at night, I'm sure you've noticed that. So they were laid early in the morning of the 14th of July. So they must have died in the evening of the 13th of July, or during the night of the 13th, 14th. However, they could not have died during the daytime of the 13th of July, as the defense counsel tried to suggest, because had they done so, they would have already hatched. If they'd been laid the previous day, they would have been maggots when we collected them, and they weren't. Had they been laid later in the day of the day of discovery, they wouldn't have hatched till the next day. They must have died sometime during that night period, the previous evening or the nighttime, and I testified to this fact. In the judge's summing up, he stated, and I shall read this, "And I found that evidence to be the most compelling to me, especially the evidence of the entomologist. I find that after hearing all the evidence, real and circumstantial, that has been put forward, that it points to only one logical conclusion, and I am satisfied that the Crown has proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt, and that both of the accused I find guilty of the two offences as been charged, and that is the ruling of this court." Both defendants were found guilty of two counts of poaching under the Provincial Wildlife Act, and they received jail time. This is the first time in Canada that poachers who actually kill the animal actually received jail time. 6 months is the maximum sentence under the law. It was appealed down to 3 months, and I believe they served one. But the point is they served jail time, and this is very, very unusual. Also, the point is the judge considered the entomological evidence very important. So I'm hoping that this case will lead to more people showing an interest and a concern about poaching, and also more wildlife officers using this as an investigative tool. We're just going to switch slide trays very briefly now. So now I want to tell you a little bit about some of the research that has been involved in my lab in the last little while. When I began this subject in 1988, I discovered very quickly that there was a vast amount of knowledge that we needed and we didn't have. In fact, the last research done in Canada before my work was in 1897, which is rather embarrassing. And that was in Montreal, which has no bearing on British Columbia either. There was no data whatsoever for British Columbia. And in fact, for some strange region which I can't quite understand, considering that so many ecosystems have been studied so well, for some strange reason, carrion ecology seems to have been somewhat neglected. I really can't understand it. But still, there's not been a lot of carrion ecology done worldwide. And also, when there has been carrion ecology research done, it has not been realistic for a homicide. It may have been scientifically valid, but it wasn't useful in a homicide investigation. For instance, in the 50s, a guy did a whole bunch of research burying a load of little pigs, and that was great, except he made these nice little pine coffins for each one. And I mean, that's very nice, but in my experience, killers usually just don't have the sensitivity to do that. So it isn't applicable for a crime scene. So when I became involved in this, I wanted to establish some research, primarily in British Columbia, that was scientifically exciting, but also would be valid in a homicide investigation. I wanted to look at bodies that were found above ground, bodies that are buried, bodies that were found in water. I wanted to look at wildlife, too, so that we could back up the work we were doing with poaching cases. And I wanted to do a tremendous amount of work with insect development as well. Now, I'm in a unique position to do this kind of research because I am an academic. I'm a professor at a university. And so I have the academic background and the academic resources, and I can do the academic research, but also I go to crime scenes. I go to crime scenes with the RCMP, with the BC Coroner Service. My position is joint funded by the university, the BC Coroner Service, and the RCMP, which means that I can go out to a crime scene and go back into the lab and formulate an experimental design that will relate directly back to the crime scene. And I can take the work from the lab directly back into the court. And I think that's a unique opportunity and a really exciting opportunity for a scientist to be able to use their data so quickly back and forth in the academic setting and into the real world, into such an important system as the criminal justice system. Now, first of all, we needed a realistic model to do research. Obviously, ethically and morally, we can't be using human bodies. And although, as you've seen from some of the slides, they do use them in certain areas of the US, again, it's not very scientifically defensible because you can only have one body out at a time. And that's, it's interesting, it's anecdotal, but it's not an experiment. So we needed something that we could use in an experimental situation. And pigs are the ideal animal. The size of a pig is roughly the size of an adult torso. The skin of a pig is very similar to ours. It's so close to ours, we use it in human skin grafts. Their digestion is very similar to us in that they have the same kind of gut flora and fauna, in that they eat garbage and we eat garbage. We're omnivores. We eat from all the food groups. So our digestion, and therefore the digestion of our bodies after death, is very similar. They're hairless, and that saved my students and I from having to shave all our research animals. And of course, they're easily available in large numbers. So my first study in 1992 began looking at pig carcasses in sun in summer alone. This is my research site, a rural area of the valley. You can just see my little cages scattered around here in an open area in summer in bright sunshine. And very quickly I discovered that things were quite exciting here in BC in comparison with other areas. Now, this is a massive database, so I can't show you it all. I'm just going to show you two different groups of insects, the domestic beetles, or the skin beetles, the pyophilidae, or the cheese skippers. Traditionally, the arrival times of these insects on a dead body is thought to be, from the literature, between 3 and up to 6 months after death. Not so in BC. Between 3 weeks for the domestics, nearly 4 weeks for the pyophilidae. They're arriving much earlier than is traditionally and historically accepted from the literature, from regions that have climates very, very similar to our own. Now, this may be because our biogeoclimatic zones are quite different here. I think it also may be that there has not been a lot of research in other areas, and a lot of this data is somewhat anecdotal, but is unfortunately being used because that's all these places have. Another exciting point was related to temperature. Temperature, as I keep mentioning, is very, very important. And I've mentioned the maggot mass and how the temperature of the maggot mass shoots up and, of course, changes the microclimate and is going to affect the insect's development. We must take that into account. But my colleagues have always believed that once that maggot mass temperature goes up, it stays up. Maybe it goes up to 50 degrees Celsius and it stays there. Not true. This graph shows in black, you can see the temperature maximum and minimum of the air, the ambient temperature. The dotted line shows the internal carcass temperature. This is the maximum, and this is the minimum. So here you see the maggot mass temperature shooting up. And yes, it gets way high during the day, but not at night. It's dropping right down. So there's tremendous fluctuation. We've got a fluctuation of something like 25 degrees Celsius there. So the maggot mass is not shooting up and staying there, as is believed in certain areas. It is fluctuating greatly. This must be taken into account when we take the maggot mass into account. So next, we started to do a much bigger project. And this is when my first graduate student, Lee Dillon, started. We started to look at various biogeoclimatic zones in British Columbia. We're rather well off with biogeoclimatic zones in BC. We have 14 of them. Everybody else has like one or two. We have 14, which makes it a little awkward, but we settled on the major areas. That is the green area, the coastal western hemlock, or the coastal region, which is the whole coast of BC and all the lower mainland, the orange area here, which represents the interior, the Okanagan, and the purple area, which represents northern BC and Prince George. So these are the most populated areas of BC, so it's the areas we find most of our bodies in. So we did these three biogeoclimatic zones. We again looked at bodies above ground, but Lee looked at bodies in sun and shade, and she looked at spring, summer, and fall, as well as the three biogeoclimatic zones. And we started off using pigs that were naked, as we'd done before. However, during her first year of research, we noticed that the pigs that she was looking at in her research and the actual human homicide cases that I was involved in were decomposing in a slightly different way, particularly in the summer. Her pigs were decomposing a lot faster than my human beings. And we began to wonder if maybe the pig wasn't being a very good model here. But then we thought that one of the big differences might be clothing, that a lot of the cases that I dealt with were actually clothed, and perhaps clothing was the parameter that was making a big difference. So we sent out an innocent little request to SFU News asking for some old clothing, which made it to Reuters, went international, and I still do receive small care packages of underwear on occasions now. People thought this was terribly amusing, of course, but naturally it was done for perfectly scientific reasons. When Lee went back through some of my old cases, we found that over 50% of my cases from 1988 to 1994, the victims were fully clothed. A further 21% were partially clothed. Only 21% were naked, and of those 21%, most of them were partly covered in a sleeping bag or a rag or a blanket or something. So most of them were associated with cloth in some manner. And of course, clothing does make a difference. It protects the body, it keeps moisture in, it absorbs body fluids itself, so it becomes attractive in its own right, and it will delay and extend decomposition. So after this point, excuse me, we clothed all our pigs. And we would like to point out that we are not the first people to think of putting clothing on pigs. So all of our carcasses after this point were clothed. Now again, this is a massive database, and I can't even begin at this point to give it justice. But just again to highlight some of the things that Lee found in her thesis, again, historically we're finding insects arriving much earlier than has been historically reported. So historically insects are thought to arrive months after death. Not true. In British Columbia, they're coming weeks after death. Just highlighting the vital need to be doing this kind of research in every area where you're trying to use forensic entomology in casework. Back to the temperature, of course, we're always interested in temperature. The red line represents the ambient temperature. This is the high, and this is the low. The yellow lines represent the internal carcass temperature. And again, the high and the low, she confirmed what I'd already thought, that we had a temperature difference here. But what Lee found that was really exciting was right here. This is the maggot mass starting to form here and shooting up. This is where, in certain situations, the oldest maggots left the body, meaning that the oldest maggots are not actually being impacted by this maggot mass at all in certain situations. Not all situations, certainly, but in certain situations, particularly in the shaded conditions. And this means that people who are automatically assuming that the maggot mass has to be taken into consideration are going to be underestimating their time since death by several days. So this is very, very exciting. Here's Lee here. Lee is presently a coroner with the BC Coroner Service in New Westminster. During her research, we also looked at wildlife. During this time, we were lucky to get donations of bears that have been killed as nuisance bears. You hear in the news, unfortunately, all the time of a bear that's been killed because it's too close to a school or something like that. Well, normally those carcasses are incinerated. During her project, we acquired the bears and we used them in our research beside the pigs so that we can compare the two to make sure that what we were doing in the pigs in the big database was going to be valid in wildlife too, and it is. But one of the most exciting things I think about doing this kind of research is the relationship that the research has in the real world. And during the first part of Lee's research, I was called into a case where a young street kid was kidnapped and killed, and her skeletonized remains were found later. I estimated time since death as 32 days minimum, based on a lot of insect development work that I'd done in the lab. I've done a tremendous amount of work looking at insect development under various conditions and various temperatures, etc. And so based on that, I was able to determine that death had occurred on or before 32 days prior to discovery. Now, time of death was a very important issue, and defense immediately attacked this, as they always will, of course, and attacked the fact that my work was all in the lab, and said, well, could it not be different in the field? Well, yes, of course, it could. I was pretty confident of my data, but yes, of course, it could be different in the field. It was a valid argument. This was in preliminary court when I first testified. By the time I went back to Supreme Court, though, some months later, Lee had completed the first part of her research, and one of her seasons completely duplicated this crime scene. It was exactly the same temperature, climatic situation as we'd seen in this crime scene. And her first flies of that species emerged exactly 32 days after they had been laid as eggs, exactly confirming my lab data. So I was able to take her data from the field and take it into the courtroom some 3 weeks after it had been gathered and use it to help convict someone of first-degree murder. So I think it's very exciting for me as a scientist and also for my graduate students working in my lab to know how quickly and how importantly our work can be used. Now, the second project was looking at burial. Bodies in British Columbia are buried very commonly. So we wanted to look at the effect of burial on insect colonization. And this is my second graduate student, Shera van Leerhoven, who's presently doing her PhD now in Arkansas. Just again, it's a big project. I'm just going to show you some of the highlights and show you the comparison of above ground to below ground bodies over a short period of time. This is an above ground pig. After 2 weeks, you can see there's maggot masses all over it. So above ground, a buried pig at 2 weeks. The body is still bloated. The other pig went through bloat some 10 days earlier, perhaps. There's no insect evidence here, and the tissue is still all intact. So very much slowed down decomposition. At 6 weeks, pretty much just skin and bone. A lot of empty pupil cases, these black things here. 6 weeks under the ground, though, body is still pretty much intact. We've now got some insect activity, but quite different from that above ground. And at 3 months, just a little bit of the skin and the bones left. Lots of insect remains here. And at 3 months, again, the body is still pretty much intact. Most of the tissue has turned to adipocere, or a fatty change into a kind of chalky material, which sticks around for a long time. Very different insects colonizing. So decomposition is greatly slowed down by burial. Decomposition was slowed down, and it encouraged some species of insects. Some species were much more keen to burrow on down to a buried body than they ever would have been to go to an above-ground body. Some insects were completely discouraged. Some insects would be the same species on both bodies, but they would arrive at different times. So we would find the species on an above-ground body at 6 weeks after death, but on buried we find it at 2 weeks after death, showing that you can't extrapolate data from the above ground to the buried scenario. And of course, different species were found in each case as well. Again, back to my favorite temperature. The yellow is representing the internal carcass temperature of the above ground body. So there's the maggot mass peak. The blue represents the air ambient temperature. The pink line is the soil temperature. And look at that white line practically on top of it. That's the internal carcass temperature of the buried body. So the buried body is following the internal the soil temperature almost exactly. In other words, when we're trying to analyze a buried body, we should be looking at the temperature of the soil, not of the air. Also, there's no maggot mass, because there's no massive maggots forming on the body. So there's no maggot mass peak. So we should not be taking a maggot mass into consideration in a buried body either. Next thing we want to look at is water. People are always asking me, what happens if you drop a body in water? So my next graduate student, Nikki Hobashak, looked at bodies in water. We looked at bodies in creeks and in ponds. And she has developed a database of the insects and other arthropods that colonize the body over this kind of time frame. And Nikki graduated about a year ago and is now presently a BC coroner for the Vancouver region. So what next? Well, the next thing I really wanted to work at is looking at a marine database. Nobody's really done any research in the marine environment. And, of course, there aren't any insects, but there are lots of other arthropods and other interesting insects, other interesting beasts that will come and colonize the body. Also, we wanted to look at decomposition in the marine environment, because that's going to be quite different, too. And looking at time and, of course, manner of death in this case. And, of course, British Columbia has tons of waterways. We have a lot of ocean. So it's very important for us to look at this kind of an area. And it's very promising because there are things like barnacles, for instance, which have a predictable life cycle, grow at a predictable rate, and will colonize, as you can see on the shoes and the trousers here. So this should be eminently predictable if we have the data. Unfortunately, I found that Vancouverites who own waterfront property have been remarkably reluctant to loan me a bit of that waterfront property to drop a few pigs off of. Can't understand it. So it's been very difficult to do this kind of research, but recently in collaboration with the RCMP, with the Underwater Death Investigation Dive Team, we have put forward a research proposal which will hopefully begin after April 1st now, once the RCMP vessels are back in the water. So after the fiscal year, when the RCMP Lindsay is back in the water, we'll be going out with the dive team with their expertise and most importantly with their very nice boat, and take it out into the deep ocean where we can do these kind of studies. So we're very grateful for this collaboration. And hopefully, come April, we will start this research. We also want to look at drug research. Drugs such as cocaine and heroin, but also therapeutic drugs like Valium, are often found in a body. and they can have a major effect on insect development. However, the reports in the literature are very contradictory, and it's difficult to predict exactly what these drugs do. So I would like to clarify this by looking at some of the drugs that we deal with here in the Lower Mainland and throughout British Columbia with some of the species of insects that we deal with here to clarify this so we can use this and take it into account when we're analyzing these insects. Again, I want to look at temperature, of course, my favorite bit. What temperature are the maggots exposed to? I've talked quite a bit about the maggot mass, but the maggot mass changes its temperature right at the center. It's very hot. It's, of course, quite cool on the outside. And if you've ever watched maggots on a roadkill or something, you see they're forever moving. They're rolling in and out. They go down feed. They come out to breathe, and then they go back down and feed. You can see this movement constantly happening. Well, so what temperature are they actually exposed at? 50 degrees in the center or 20 degrees outside? So I want to find out what temperature these insects are actually being exposed to know how we take this into account. What time exactly do the maggots leave? Lee's work has led to a lot of interesting questions about this, and we want to know exactly when the maggots leave and when they leave early. What are the effects of temperature fluctuations as opposed to a constant temperature? What are the thresholds of temperature? Insects will stop developing when it gets cold, but at what temperature? Again, very conflicting knowledge in the literature. And each instar, of course, will be quite different as well. What kind of distance will the maggots travel? So do I have to worry about cross-contamination from a dead deer 10 feet away, 100 feet away? Of course, we want to computerize the database so that we can put all of this information into a massive database for easy retrieval and analysis of cases right across Canada. And of course, we're also involved in developing a database right across Canada. We have a nice database for BC, although not finished, but we have a lot of data for this area. I have a student working in Edmonton. She's got 2 years' worth of work now. One will be starting in Saskatoon this following January. Another has been working in Winnipeg, one of my grad students, for over a year now. And we have students working in the Maritimes. Hopefully, I have a student starting in the Yukon this summer also. So the aim is to develop a database like we have in BC for each of the provinces, for each of the biogeoclimatic zones of Canada, so that we can use this kind of evidence with confidence in each of these areas. So basically, the research is really taking off now. And the basic message here is that insects are evidence. It's not too many years ago that the police would, you know, kind of clean off the bugs so they could see the real evidence, you know, the bullet wound or whatever. And now they recognize that the insects are the evidence. I'd like to thank the following people and organizations. And that's the end.
Dr. Anderson has kindly said she'd take some questions, so if you have one, put your hand up. No questions? Repeat the questions, would you?
The question was, what does alcohol or smoking have an effect on insect development? I don't know about smoking, but alcohol certainly does not, because alcohol is a normal product of decomposition. So the insects that live on a dead body are used to living on decomposed remains and used to living on alcohol, so they've evolved to handle that. So that shouldn't be an effect. I don't know about smoking, though. Yeah, it could well have an effect. Yes? How long does it take a body in a coffin to decompose in our area? That entirely depends on whether it's been embalmed or not. If it's not embalmed and it's very well sealed, in today's coffins we have to bury them very deeply and in a concrete vault. I would suspect decomposition will be fairly slow. And we've exhumed bodies after many, many years and they can still be intact. The wetter the area, the quicker they will decompose. So in Louisiana, about 4 months, I think, been around here quite a while. Yes?
A lot of people try to keep their houses insect-free with all kinds of insect sprays and other gimmicks. Now, if somebody grows a little bit interested in insect-free in house, does that really mean that there are no insects in the house?
There's no such thing as an insect-free house. The question is if a person keeps their house insect-free, will insects get to the body? Yes, they will. If you can breathe in that house, insects can get in. It may take them a while, but there are ways in under things, around things, through ventilations, etc. It'll take them a while. I have seen insects colonizing a body in the back in a car, which was completely sealed. But there's those little ventilation things in the trunk. They get in that way. Not greatly. We had one case. The question was, have I ever dealt with burnt bodies? And the answer is no, I haven't, not really. We've had one or two cases come in, but usually if the body is entirely burnt, then there's nothing for the insects. Now, if it's just a bit burnt, it's just kind of cooked, then insects don't mind, just like they come to your cooked food. And it's very, very difficult, extremely difficult to dispose of a human body. There's a lot of water in a body. Almost impossible to dispose of a body by fire completely. So if there's some flesh left, the insects would still be attracted. It's not horrible, it's great. That man there, Dr. John Borden. Dr. John Borden was one of my senior supervisors for my PhD, and he was one of the first people, together with Professor Thelma Finlayson, who's sitting here, who was involved at SFU in forensic entomology back in the 70s and 80s. And I was a grad student at that time, and John wanted somebody to take it on, so I said, well, I'll give it a try and see if it's interesting. And I'm still here 10 years later. The question is, how do we collect the data from the buried bodies? We buried quite a number of animals, and then at every time period, we would exhume 3, the minimum you could ever do for any kind of analysis, and then that was it. So we didn't dig them up and bury them again and dig them up and bury them again, except in some specific experiments where we were interested in digging them up and burying them again and seeing what that did. But mostly, we just incinerated the carcasses after that. There are two questions. The first is the disease transmission. I'll address that first. Hepatitis is certainly a disease that can stick around for a long time, and anybody working in this field is vaccinated against hepatitis B, but certainly that is possible. I have read of cases where they said that AIDS can be detected in the maggot. I frankly have some doubts. The only reason that would work is if the maggot mass were to keep the temperature up to an appropriate temperature, because AIDS is actually, thank God, very fragile and does not survive outside of the body for very long at all when it gets a little cooler. The second question related to how long after the body has died that insects will no longer be of value. Well, insects will still be attractive to the body if there is anything there to eat. So museum curators, for instance, spend most of their life trying to keep insects out of their museum collections. And so that can be very, very ancient things that are still attracting insects. If you think if you ever give your dog a bone, and they bury it out in the yard, and they find it 2 years later, if it's still slightly greasy, there's still fat there, there's still something that's attractive. But realistically, in a useful manner, I would say insects should only be used for about 18 months to 2 years. They have been used in cases up to 10 years after death, but usually in that kind of case, you're looking at a corroboration of something else. There was a case in the U.S. where an elderly man, was responsible for 2 old ladies, his elderly mother and his elderly sister, and they were completely bedridden. And he collected their pension checks every month. They hadn't been seen for years. It's known as the psycho case. One day he didn't come to pick up his pension checks, and so they went out to the house to see what had happened. And he had died quite naturally, but he'd been dead for several days. So they went to check on the two old ladies, and both of them were extremely dead, had been very, very dead for a very long time. Now, the entomologist determined that the season of death, based on the kinds of insects, and indicated a minimum elapsed time of about 2 years, which I think is kind of stretching it. But they were actually dead for 10 years, and that was based on the Christmas cards that, like a dutiful son and brother, he had placed by their beds every year, whether they were dead or alive. And so the police simply went through the Christmas cards to see at what point he stopped opening them. So that was 10 years. Yes? Yes. The question is, how would you use insects to determine if a body has been moved from one place to another? Well, it would only occur in very specific situations, but insects, for instance, that like a city are quite different from those that you'll find in the rural regions. So if you were to murder somebody in downtown Vancouver, and most people, when they've killed somebody, are not quite aware of really how very difficult it is to dispose of a body and move it around. And so they may have thought this through, but then they've realized they've got a very heavy, very nasty body on their hands. So they're going to leave it there and come back and get it later. So they leave the body at the first site, say inside of a city, for a few hours. It's not going to take long for insects to colonize, lay eggs. We're just dealing with eggs. When the killer comes back with his best friend in his best friend's truck, he's not going to notice the few little fly eggs in the eyes and the wound. If he does, he's not going to think about them. If he thinks about them and has watched enough television and realized they could be used against him, and he might try to get rid of them, he's never going to get rid of them all. So he's going to pick up that body and take it out into the bush, out to Abbotsford, say, and dump it out there, and we'll find it 3 weeks later. The insects on the body will also belong to Abbotsford, but there's going to be those older insects that got there first, and they belong in the city. Now, I'm not going to be able to say it's Vancouver over Seattle, but chances are you didn't bring the dead body over the international border, so likely it's Vancouver. So that would indicate where the death took place, and that could be very important in a police investigation. Was she murdered in the city, or was she lured out to the valley where she was murdered? Does it make a difference if the pig is wearing polyester or wool? Yeah, it could actually, because certain fibers decompose at different rates. We haven't found that, but I think over a very long term you might find some differences. We looked at two or three layers of clothing as well, because that did seem to make a difference. I honestly don't why that. The question is, why are all my assistants women? My first three graduated students are women, and my present grad students are women also. The guy who's going to do the White Horse one will be my first Y chromosome with luck. So we will be able to break that, we're hoping. I don't know why. Women seem to take this sort of thing a lot better. I find men a lot more squeamish usually. I don't know why. I think there's a sort of a sorting mechanism for this, a selection mechanism when kids are about five. And boys never have to go through it, but girls do. Because some girls, the mother says, oh, don't do that, dear, it's gross. And some of them say, oh, yes, you're right, it is. And the rest of us say, no, it's not, it's really neat. Look what happens when we do this. And so we were kind of selected for at age five. And boys never had to do this until they hit about 18. And I find them usually a lot more squeamish. The question is about forensic anthropology. Forensic anthropology is quite different. It's looking at the bones. An anthropologist looks at the bones, the skeleton. From the skeleton, they will tell the age, the height, the race of the victim. They might tell wound patterns and things like that. Anything that's related to the hard skeleton. An anthropologist and I will often work closely at the crime scene, but we're doing quite different things. The question relates to the kind of drugs we want to look at. We want to look at the effects that insects on insects of the drugs. So we would probably be putting the drugs into an animal and then feeding the insects on that. It's always possible to get in vitro situations where you can do that as well. There have been studies done in the US where they've put drugs into animals and then they fed the insects purely on the liver tissue. And that, of course, got a result. But the problem is, in a real homicide, that's not what happens. The insects don't just go digging around to find the liver. They eat the whole thing. And obviously, drugs do concentrate in the liver. So research in France, which used the whole animal, found quite contradictory results. So I'd really like to try and clarify that. Not as yet, but probably will. I have spoken with them.
I don't think we heard the question.
Sorry, the question was Da Vinci's inquest, and have I been involved in that yet? A very good friend of mine is actually very heavily involved in advising for that, so no doubt we'll have insects on one of them eventually. What courses do you need to take at university? Well, you need in general a basic first degree, a bachelor's degree in preferably entomology or at least zoology, biology, with obviously a heavy emphasis in entomology. A master's degree then in entomology, preferably forensics if you can do it, but in some aspect of development or ecology of insects. The ideal would then be to have a PhD in the field also if you wish to be board certified at least. Do I ever use bacterial evidence? Is there any use for it? I don't. That's not my field. I think there's a great use for it, but nobody's really researched that. I think there should be a tremendous succession in the bacteria that colonize a body over time, but that's not my expertise, so I'm not doing that. Is forensic entomology going to need to become more detailed as defense lawyers become more educated? I don't know about detail. I mean, I think we need to become more detailed at all levels. But at the moment, defense counsel will ask those kind of questions. I think as defense counsel becomes more knowledgeable, they will actually understand it better and probably understand that there isn't that much difference in this and this, but this has a big impact. I find actually that my report is now being accepted into court without me going to have to defend it more and more. It used to be that they say, who? An entomologist? This I want to talk to. And so I testify a lot, and now I find that invariably I'm subpoenaed, and they just, no, they just accepted the report. That was all that was needed. So I think they're accepting it more. But I go in as an expert witness, so I try to educate whichever counsel I'm dealing with. The question is, do we have conflicting testimony from different experts testifying on different sides? Yes, we do. Less so in Canada. It's more common in the U.S. to keep buying the more expensive expert witness. And I am a present rebutting a rebutting witness in the U.S. at the moment. Usually, when an expert witness goes on the stand in Canada at the moment, you go in as an unbiased witness, you make your statement, and that is challenged by counsels, and that's about it. I have had my testimony challenged by another entomologist, but only in writing. They didn't actually testify against me. But that will come, I'm sure. Oh, sorry, where? This lady, sorry. The question is about the Canadian database and how long will it take to do it. We're doing very well, actually. I'm very pleased with where we're going. You saw the biogeoclimatic zone map of BC. We're the worst. We have 14 biogeoclimatic zones. Most of the other provinces only have two or three, and those biogeoclimatic zones are shared by a whole bunch. So by doing one project in Alberta, one in Manitoba, one in Saskatchewan, we cover the three biogeoclimatic zones that cover the three areas completely. As yet, there's been no interest from Ontario and Quebec in this field whatsoever, and the maritime region is predominantly, aside from Newfoundland, one major biogeoclimatic zone. So we are right now, or at least we will be once we get into the Yukon, in most of the biogeoclimatic zones across Canada. Now within those there are microclimates. I hope to have the major climatic stuff, the major biogeoclimatic zones done within the next 3 or 4 years. But within each, of course, there are major differences and major microclimates, and those we will have to look at as well. But the big stuff will hopefully be done soon. Yes, the question is, have anybody tried to treat the body with chemicals or insecticides? Yes, they have, and usually they fail. Insecticides, the kind of insecticides that you and I can get our hands on legally and easily, are usually designed to kill, they're fairly minor, and they're also designed to kill flying insects like raid and things like that. To get anything really heavy duty, you need licenses and stuff, and then we can trace you. And insecticides don't actually have much of an impact on the maggots. There was a case in Washington State that a friend worked on where a young man decided to commit suicide. He shot himself in the head. One of those weird situations where he kind of missed, it just kind of skimmed the back of the head and left a nasty bit of a bullet burn around the back of his head. He was taken off to the hospital where he was treated for a nasty bit of a bullet burn around the back of his head, and then he was seen by a psychiatrist where he was deemed to be no longer a danger to himself or society. He was sent home. On the way home, he purchased a rope, he went home, and he hung himself. He was found, he was unhooked, he was packed back to the hospital, where he was seen for a nasty bit of a rope burn around his neck, and then seen by the same psychiatrist, where he was deemed to be no longer a danger to himself or society. He went home. On the way home, he purchased a bottle of diazinon. He went into his mother's basement, and he drank the diazinon. That did it. He successfully killed himself. About 3 days later, his mother hadn't seen him around, and she was a bit concerned about this. Under the circumstances, you would have thought she'd have checked earlier, but still. She went down there 3 days later. He was very dead, and the maggots were feeding actually in the mouth. Now, he had orally taken diazinon, which is a very potent insecticide, and they were feeding on that tissue. I think what probably happened is the adult flies would have flown in, attracted to the body, would have been killed probably by the diazinon. But if you think of a dying fly, or more commonly perhaps think of a dying plant, a tree, it produces the best flowers or the best pine cones it ever will produce in the year it's dying, because this is its last chance to reproduce. The fly will do the same. As she flies in, she realizes she's dying, she will extrude her eggs. And the eggs did just fine. In fact, they could even get the pesticide back out of the body, and out of the insects, and prove it was diazinon. So I don't think that would be very successful. There was a question at the back somewhere. Mm-hmm. It would be lovely to have the luxury to do that. It would be lovely, but of course, with funding the way it is, etc., it just isn't possible. The question was could we duplicate every single case in a research setting? The question is that every little situation in the microclimate might be different. And yes, that is true. But bear in mind that a database will take years to develop. We have done that in rare situations. But to try to duplicate each situation, it's not going to be in time for court. We're not going to be able to repeat that. I did in one case in Ontario where they collected the insects for me, and they said, here they are. And I said, thank you very much, but there's nothing I can do with them because I don't have a database for this region. And they kept saying, oh, please. And I kept saying, no, I can't. There's nothing I can do. And eventually they said, well, what could we do for you that would make you be able to develop these? I said, okay, I need some pigs put out there this time next year. And luckily we had a long enough time frame because it was a long trial. The following year we put out carcasses at the exact same place of the victim. We collected that whole summer, and I was able to submit that in a report the following year. Normally we don't have that luxury.
I think that's a very good note on which to ask President Jack Blaney from Simon Fraser University to thank our speaker.
Well, Professor Anderson makes it very easy to thank her. One thing she has done, I think, wonderfully well, in addition to presenting her topic, is to show how the universities are drawing on the basic sciences, working with groups in the community, working on contemporary problems that are relevant to us every day. Gail, I thought your lecture was absolutely brilliant. I've heard a variation of it before. My attention was 100%. I think that everybody here found it absolutely interesting, and I think it was absolutely brilliantly and splendidly delivered. And from everybody here, Gail, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.